Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and the Yale Club Silicon Valley. My name is Kirk Hansen. I'm director of the Markela Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University and a member of the Commonwealth Club's Silicon Valley Advisory Board. It's my pleasure to introduce Joseph Cumming, director of the Reconciliation Program for the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. Joseph received his bachelor's degree in religion from Princeton University, a master's in divinity from Fuller University, and master's degrees in philosophy and the arts from Yale University. He spent time in the Islamic Republic of Mauritania, where he served as the director of the Deleuze Community, a Christian humanitarian organization that worked to better the lives of Mauritania's poorest, and served as president of the National Federation of NGOs in Mauritania. Fluent in Arabic, Joseph has lectured at Uzair University in Cairo and has been involved in the high-profile Muslim-Christian discussions, including the Doha Conference on Interfaith Dialogue and the Summit for Interfaith Respect. As well as directing the newly established Reconciliation Program at the Yale University Divinity School, Joseph is an ordained Christian minister, teaches courses in Islamic studies at Fuller Theological Seminary, and is completing his doctorate in Islamic studies and Christian theology at Yale University. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Joseph Cumming.
Well, let me first say thank you to everyone for coming. I'm always encouraged to see that there are still people who care about peace in the Middle East. There are many people in this country and in other countries around the world who feel a sense of despair when they think about peace in the Middle East. So I think it's appropriate. Tonight's topic is posed as a question: is Middle East peace possible? I think there are a lot of people who feel despair. I am not one of them. I believe, yes, peace is possible in the Middle East. And in fact, there is a great window of opportunity for peace in the Middle East right now at this present time. But it is a window of opportunity that will not stay open forever. And I think it's a critically important time to seize that opportunity. I think there's a window of opportunity for a few reasons. I'm going to mention two of them. First of all, is that there is tremendous excitement right across the Muslim world about the inauguration of President Obama. And I don't mean that as a slap against President Bush, but there is tremendous excitement across the Muslim world about the election and inauguration of President Obama. There's a tremendous feeling of hope that maybe things can be different. After years of, you know, throughout the Muslim world, when I talk with Muslims, generally a feeling of despair about peace, the inauguration of President Obama has dramatically changed that overnight. I just recently had the privilege of participating in the U.S. Islamic World Forum meeting in Doha, Qatar, which is an annual meeting of senior U.S. leaders and senior leaders from around the Muslim world. From the Muslim side, there were a number of heads of state, many government ministers there, some of the top sort of prominent stars of the news media and of the arts and academia across the Muslim world. And it was unbelievable, as I talk with these Muslim leaders, just to see their excitement. I mean, real palpable excitement about feeling like, wow, now there's an administration in Washington that we feel like might be able to make peace in the Middle East. There's an administration in Washington that we feel will listen to our concerns. They're not stupid. They're not naive. They don't think that President Obama is going to do everything that they want him to do. They've already pointing out all kinds of things that he's done that they don't like or failed to do that they wish he would do. But they're feeling like he and his administration are prepared to listen before they speak, listen with as sympathetic an ear as they're able to do. And there's tremendous excitement about that. While I was at that conference, I was interviewed on Al Jazeera. You know, Al Jazeera, the major international news network in the Arab world, which it's kind of intimidating when you're interviewed on Al Jazeera because they have 40 million viewers at any given time. So you think, boy, do I ever want to say this right and not say it wrong when I'm talking to 40 million Arab Muslims. And I've done interviews on Al Jazeera a number of times in the past, and I can tell you every time I've ever been interviewed on Al Jazeera in the past, the questioner was always on the attack. Always the questions were like, well, not hostile, but definitely, you know, they were not friendly questions. And boy, was it different this time. I've never gotten such easy softball questions pitched to me by a TV interviewer in any country. Just really, you know, basically, how can we work with you and help us understand President Obama and help us understand the American people and help us understand how Americans feel about this and that? How do Christians feel about this or that? How do Jews feel about this or that? Tremendous openness that I've just never seen before, and real warmth from and not just from the interviewer, but from everybody I dealt with in the management of Al Jazeera. There's just really been a sea change in attitudes. At the same time, I say this is a window of opportunity that will not stay open forever. Across the Muslim world, people are saying, let's see whether President Obama's rhetoric, what kind of action does it translate into? Obviously, they're not happy that he has not been as forthcoming about the warrantless wiretapping as they had hoped he would be. They're watching closely whether he will really close Guantanamo Bay. They're very excited about his declassifying those memos on interrogation techniques. Obviously, they would like to see the Obama administration prosecute people who are responsible for those interrogation techniques. I'm sure you've all followed in the news. I don't know whether they will or won't. There's deep concern across the Muslim world. Why is he increasing troops in Afghanistan? That's seen as not helpful. A feeling that so far, from the point of view of Muslims, he's done nothing on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. For across the Muslim world, not just the Middle East, but throughout the Muslim world, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict really is the chief issue, the dominant issue. It's the key to everything else. I think that any Muslim will tell you America will never have normal relations with the Muslim world until we deal with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And if we could bring about a just peace, a just peaceful resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, every other problem in relations between America and the Muslim world could be resolved. I don't mean those other problems would go away. There are other deep issues that need to be dealt with in the U.S.-Islamic world relationship, but all of those issues would instantly become much easier to solve if the Israeli-Palestinian conflict were not there as an open wound radicalizing public opinion in the Muslim world toward the U.S. The Muslim world, you know, when the recent war in Gaza took place, it was on our TV screens in the American news media as long as it was going on. But once it passed, right? And today the news media is talking only about the Chrysler bankruptcy and the swine flu epidemic. In fact, I watched CNN this morning for half an hour, and that was the only two stories, as though nothing else was happening in the world. But I can tell you, in the Muslim world, in the Muslim news media, they are still talking about Gaza every single day. Every single day, talking about hundreds of thousands of people made homeless. All of the children who are killed and maimed and everything, it's an open wound, and people are waiting, when is this going to be dealt with? When is this going to be dealt with? When is this going to be dealt with? So there's a window of opportunity but it's a window of opportunity that that won't stay open forever. I'm going to come back in a little while to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, because that, of all of the conflicts, I think is the one that people have most despair about, and that I really do have hope about. But I want first to say the other thing that I think represents a real window of opportunity right now, and that is what is happening in relations among the religious leaders of the Muslim, Christian, and Jewish communities that dominate the political picture in the Middle East. And this is something that I think often American academia and the American news media do not fully understand: the reality that in the Middle East, most people do not really trust their political leaders, but they do trust their religious leaders. This is also true, I think, in the U.S. Not true for everybody in the U.S., but it's probably true for the majority of Americans. The majority of Americans trust their pastor, their rabbi, their imam, more than they trust their congressman or congresswoman or senator. And I think that's something that American society and Middle Eastern society have in common, that most people trust their religious leaders more than they trust their political leaders. And political leaders can only make peace if public opinion will let them make peace. Bill Clinton, President Clinton, said privately after the summit meeting at Camp David with Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Chairman Yasser Arafat, there was a lot of talk afterwards, well, there was this great deal on the table, why didn't Arafat take the deal? And Bill Clinton has said privately in a number of contexts, the deal that was on the table, if Yasser Arafat had taken that deal and gone home to Palestine with that, he would have been killed. And he was trusted by the Palestinian people more than President Mahmoud Abbas. The only way that the Palestinian political leadership or the Israeli political leadership or the American political leadership can make peace is if public opinion will let them make peace, if public opinion will support a peace deal. And when it comes to moving public opinion, I think religious leaders actually have more power to move public opinion on the issues that affect Middle East peace than political leaders. And that's why I think it's hugely significant that the last couple of years have seen really the last 4 or 5 years have seen really a sea change in the attitude within the Muslim, Christian, and Jewish religious communities towards interfaith dialogue, towards one another's faiths. And there are a number of initiatives. For many years, interfaith dialogue was described, one prominent Orthodox Jewish scholar, Irving Greenberg, has said that too much Christian-Jewish dialogue has consisted of Christians who don't really believe in Christianity and Jews who don't really believe in Judaism sitting down together and discovering how much they have in common. Now, he's, of course, saying that in jest, and I think he fully recognized that's a little bit unfair to the people who have participated in those dialogues and who they would say, I do really believe in my faith. I do take my faith seriously. But there's a sense in which interfaith dialogue, the pioneers of that, have consisted of people who represented the liberal fringes of their respective religious communities, who got along pretty well with each other, but were not able to move the masses of their respective communities. The mainstream leaders who commanded loyalty in the streets and in the pews and in the mosques and in the synagogues and the churches were not involved, or were involved only marginally. And that has really changed in the last few years, where now the leaders, religious leaders right across the spectrum, from liberal to conservative, from every major branch of every major faith, are saying we do want to engage in dialogue with others. We believe we can be faithful to our core convictions and engage in dialogue with the other. And in fact, we must, because if we don't, we're going to blow each other up. In fact, if we don't, we are blowing each other up. Not just we might potentially, but that's what we are doing, and we're going to destroy the world if we don't do this. I think there have been a number of very exciting initiatives that that have been highlighted in the news media in recent years. Some of them you may have seen. I think perhaps the most exciting is an initiative known as the Common Word. This was in October of 2007. An open letter was sent by the Muslim leaders of the world, addressed to the Christian leaders of the world, titled "A Common Word Between Us and You." And unlike any other interfaith initiative before, this one was signed by the top leaders of every major branch of Islam. And, you know, oftentimes people say, well, who speaks for Islam? Who speaks for Muslims? Who, you know, and the news media is looking for this person or that person, you know. And, well, this person sounds really nice, but does he or she really speak for Muslims? And that person sounds awful, but does he or she really speak for Muslims? Like, who... You know, this was for the first time for the 85% of the Muslim world that Sunni, I would say the leaders who signed this really were truly like a who's who of all of the top leaders. And on the Shiite side, it was not quite a who's who, but certainly many very, very senior and prominent Shiite leaders from all of the major branches of Shiism signed this open letter to the Christian leaders of the world saying, could we put the relations between our communities, who between them make up 55% of the human race, could we put those relations on a new footing based on the two commands to love God and love your neighbor as you love yourself? And, well, what can you say if you're a Christian and you get a letter from Muslims saying, could we put our relations on the basis of love God and love your neighbor as you love yourself? That's pretty hard to disagree with when Jesus said that those are the two most important commandments. And this was received with great enthusiasm in the Christian community. And there are a number of prominent Christian responses. The Vatican, the Pope wrote a response. The head of the World Lutheran Federation wrote a response. The World Council of Churches wrote a response. But actually, probably the one that was, hope you'll forgive me for tooting Yale's horn a little bit here, but I think probably the one that received the most prominence was one that a group of us at Yale drafted called Loving God and Neighbor Together, although most people refer to it as the Yale response. And the reason why it became so prominent is it was signed by a wide range of Christians from every major branch of Christianity, from Eastern Orthodox to Roman Catholic to mainline Protestant to, for the first time ever, evangelical Protestant. And really this was the first time that really all of the top leaders of evangelical Protestantism, the head of the World Evangelical Alliance, the head of the National Association of Evangelicals, et cetera, signed on to participate in an interfaith dialogue. And we had the privilege of hosting all of these ayatollahs and muftis and all of these Christian leaders at a conference at Yale this last July. And it was really beautiful, I think, to see. These are, both on the Christian side and the Muslim side, these are the people who do command the loyalty of millions and millions of people around the world. And to see them embracing, literally, and having constructive conversations. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't serious problems. And, you know, you don't get to that kind of level of leadership if you're a naive person. And there are real issues that need to be dealt with. One very important issue was this Muslim-Christian thing, was it excluding Jews? And so we made a point right from the outset of saying, even though the original letter was written from Muslims to Christians, let's have Jewish participants in this as well. And we had prominent or Orthodox, conservative, and Reform Jewish leaders participating throughout the whole process. And you can think of the range of difficult issues that Muslims, Christians, and Jews are not necessarily going to agree on right away. And some of our conversations were, let's just say, candid. But at the same time, really genuinely in a spirit of love. When you're saying we're meeting around the idea of loving each other as we love ourselves, it's hard then to act unloving in that context. And there was really a sense of hope that, you know, we can make peace. We're not going to agree about everything. We pretty much thought we're not going to agree about the Trinity. We're not going to agree about the person of Jesus Christ or the prophethood of Muhammad. or whether the Jews are God's chosen people. Those are things we're probably not going to agree on. But we can make peace with each other. And this has generated tremendous excitement across the Muslim world. It's been covered much more in the Muslim press than in the Western press, but including imams preaching about this to stadiums full of tens of thousands of young Muslims in the Middle East, talking about your chief duty towards Christians and Jews is to love them as you love yourself. Now, that's not the image of Islam you usually get if you watch TV in this country. Muslim religious leaders speaking to a stadium of 40,000 young Muslims and saying, your duty towards Christians and Jews is to love them as you love yourself. But that's the kind of thing that's happening. And with it, a shifting of public opinion towards one another that can make peace possible. That can make peace possible. And I think that faith can be exploited to drive people apart, and faith can be interpreted to promote peace. When people feel that they are oppressed, when they feel that they are humiliated, when they feel that there is no response that they could possibly make to that, then violence, then they start digging in their religious tradition looking for a justification why it would be okay to do what their hearts are telling them to do. But when they feel like, you know, those people aren't so bad, they're not our enemies, they are our friends, but then they look in their religious tradition to find support for making peace. And so, for example, I said I'd come back to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. If you look at this religiously, and on the Muslim side, you have some people, including Hamas has somewhat ambiguously said, it's not as clear in Hamas's statements as some people think, that all the entire land, the historic land of Palestine, is what Muslims call waqf, that is a religious endowment, sacred territory. And you say, okay, and does that mean that no Jews or Christians can be allowed to live on that sacred Islamic space? And if on the other side you have Christians and Jews saying, well, God promised all of this same land to Abraham, and that promise is applied to Abraham's descendants through Isaac, but not to Abraham's descendants through Ishmael, well, then you have two mutually incompatible absolute claims, right? This land absolutely must belong exclusively to these people, or it must absolutely belong exclusively to these other people. And no amount of, Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Abbas and President Obama can sit and talk till they're blue in the face, but you're not going to be able to make peace if that is what people believe. On the other hand, Muslim scholars can go in and say, actually, there is not much in the Islamic tradition to support the idea that the entire historic land of Palestine is waqf. That's actually not well supported in the Islamic tradition. And even if it is supported in the Islamic tradition, that does not necessarily mean it cannot be shared with Christians and Jews, or even partitioned with Christians and Jews. That's not necessarily the case. And if on the Christian side you say, Jesus said, blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the land. The land belongs to the meek. And if Jews and Christians say, God's promise to Abraham could also be shared with Abraham's descendants through Ishmael, then all of a sudden, peace becomes thinkable. Now if President Obama and President Abbas and Prime Minister Netanyahu sit down together and they work out something that they could agree on, public opinion would be able to support it and not feel that they're betraying God as they understand God's will. And that's the kind of thing that is able to be made possible when Muslims, Christians, and Jews talk together, and that's the kind of thing that is happening. Now, most people in America think, but there isn't actually any deal that would be acceptable to the Israelis and the Palestinians, so what's the point? Actually, pretty much everybody who works in the field that's known as track two diplomacy, track two diplomacy meaning informal back channel contacts among parties in conflict, pretty much everybody I know who works in track two diplomacy in the Middle East will tell you there is a deal which, if it were on the table tomorrow, and if it were put in a referendum to the Palestinian people first, at least 70 to 80% of the Palestinian people would vote for it. And if the Israeli people saw that first, the Palestinians would have to vote first. The problem for Israelis, most Israelis want peace, but most Israelis believe the Palestinians don't want peace. And if the Israeli people were convinced the Palestinian people really meant it, there's no question that the majority of the Israeli people would vote for it as well. When I talk with Muslim leaders, as I do every day, they often say to me, doesn't the outcome of the recent Israeli election prove that the Israeli people don't want peace? And I say to them, no. It proves that the Israeli people are starting to give up hope for peace. Not that they don't want it, but they think that the Palestinian people don't want it. And when I say this to my Palestinian Muslim friends, and I'm pretty close to basically the top tier of Muslim religious leaders in the Palestinian territories, when I say that to them, they say, but that's ridiculous. We want peace. They're the ones who don't want peace. And when I say this to my Israeli friends, they say, well, that's ridiculous. We want peace. They're the ones who don't want peace. Both sides are genuinely convinced that they want peace. Both sides are genuinely convinced it's the other side that does not want peace. And even when you can resolve that, then people say, yes, but Hamas would never accept this deal. Hamas would never accept this deal. But actually, no. Hamas would accept the deal. And Hamas has made this very clear, not so much in their public statements. Their public statements are much less helpful, and certainly their charter is dedicated to the annihilation of Israel. But remember, the PLO's charter was once dedicated to the annihilation of Israel, and they changed it. And privately, the Hamas would accept the deal. Let me just quickly tell you what kind of deal I'm talking about. So you understand, and that is that the not only the Palestinians but the entire Arab world would recognize Israel's right to exist within secure boundaries that approximate the 1967 border. That the 1967 border would be slightly adjusted to allow for especially Ma'ale Adumim, but a couple of the larger settlement blocks, with the Palestinians being compensated with a similar amount of land and with the bare minimum of changes possible being made to the border. The old city of Jerusalem not being divided, which is unacceptable to the Israelis, not being just annexed by Israel, which is unacceptable to the Palestinians, but with sovereignty over the old city being either shared or under international sovereignty or under God's sovereignty is actually a proposal that has been mooted on both sides, with the actual administration of that being maintaining the status quo that we now have, and with the refugee issue, that is, Palestinians who left what is now the state of Israel in 1948, being resolved by a very tiny, maybe 5,000 people max are the number of Palestinian refugees who really could document that they personally back in 1948 were living in what is now Israel and could prove that in court. But the overwhelming majority of those refugees who would not be able to document that in that way, receiving generous financial compensation, which somebody would have to pay for, and the United States would be the ones who would pay for that, and that would be cheap. That would be way, way cheaper than what we are currently spending to maintain the status quo, what we are currently spending, what it costs us militarily and diplomatically to maintain the status quo is far, far more than it would cost to provide that compensation to those Palestinian refugees. There are a number of other lesser issues that need to be dealt with, water rights, notable among them. But the deal I just described, you know, there are different versions that are not exactly that. The so-called Geneva agreements is a slightly different version of that. What was on the table, not at Camp David, but shortly after the Camp David summit at Taba was similar. Everybody involved knows more or less the outlines of the deal, as President Clinton said, within a couple of degrees of what I just described. If that deal were put to a referendum of the Palestinian people tomorrow, I can tell you 78 to 80% of Palestinians would vote for it. And when Hamas saw 70 to 80% of the Palestinian people vote for it, they would say, we accept the democratic will of the Palestinian people. That doesn't mean Islamic Jihad would. You know, there still would be some extremists who would not. But mainstream Palestinian leaders, including Hamas, would accept it. And I think that if the Israeli people saw that, and that happened first, and then the same deal were put in a referendum to the Israeli people, there's no question that the majority of Israelis would vote for it. Pretty much everybody I know who's involved in Track 2 diplomacy agrees that there's really only one person on earth who can make that happen, and that is the President of the United States. Any president of the United States who wants to do it could do it. But that president would need to be willing to do it early in his or her presidency, because it would take time, and would need to be willing to expend significant political capital to persuade the Israeli prime minister and the Palestinian leadership in both Fatah and Hamas to put those referenda to their peoples and to persuade the American taxpayers to support it financially. I think any American president could do that. I'm very encouraged that President Obama is planning to meet personally with all of the parties in May and June. That suggests he does want to tackle the issue early in his presidency. Obviously, he also has a very full docket with a lot of other things, and the American people mostly want him to focus on the economy more than they want him to focus on Middle East peace. He seems to be a guy with a lot of energy who seems to be able to tackle 25 issues at once. And that leads me to be an optimist about Middle East peace. I think it is doable. It could happen. In fact, it could happen just within the next couple of years if things go the way they should. But I believe that window of opportunity will not remain open forever. It's very clear on the Palestinian side that there's growing despair, a growing loss of hope. And on the Israeli side, I think, as I've said to Muslim leaders, I think what the Israeli election shows is not that the Israeli people don't want peace, but that the Israeli people are losing hope that the Palestinian people want peace. And something has to change soon. Otherwise, despair will turn to actual unwillingness to make peace on both sides. Before we move to questions and answers, let me just share a story that I think you'll find interesting about peacemaking. This is a short story I shared at a conference at Yale that Bob Asadorian attended. Afterwards, there was a Yale alumnus published an article in the National Review saying that I was unbelievably naive about Islamic extremism. So let me just tell you, I am not naive about Islamic extremism. I have personally survived two attempts by Muslim extremist lynch mobs to kill me during my 15 years in North Africa. One of them, they were looking for me to kill me and did not find me. The second one actually was within seconds of dying. There was a crowd of about 100 young men with very long beards and turbans chanting Allahu Akbar and ripping my clothes and beating me, and I was passing out and falling down to the ground, and it was obvious I would have been dead within seconds. And then miraculously, unarmed policemen risked their lives to break through that crowd. Just a group of, I think, three policemen risked their lives to break through that crowd to rescue me from being killed. I have, during my years in North Africa, I've been arrested by the police and interrogated and threatened with torture because of my Christian faith. So I'm not naive about the ugly side of Muslim extremism, though I've also seen the ugly side of extremism in America in attitudes towards Muslims. And I have to say, many of my Muslim friends in America have experienced very similar things, and I could tell you some of their stories. So I'm not naive as I tell you this story, but I think it's an interesting story about what is possible. I met a few years ago with Sheikh Fadlallah. He's the Ayatollah who is either the most prominent or one of the two, along with Ayatollah Sistani, most prominent Shiite Ayatollahs in the Arab world. And he is best known to Americans as the founder of Hezbollah. So I'm sure that probably put me on some FBI watch list to go meet with him. And I went to meet with him, and I was in Lebanon for just a few days, and somebody I knew who knew him said, "Oh, you really ought to meet with him." So I said, "Okay." But the only day I could meet with him happened to be the day before Ashura, which is the holiest day of the year for Shiite Muslims. This is the day when Shiite Muslims commemorate the martyrdom of Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. And in the Shiite tradition, they believe that God showed Hussein that Hussein could pray and God would enable him to defeat his enemies and kill them. But instead, Hussein laid down his sword and allowed them to kill him and so won a much greater victory and gained a position of being able to pray for forgiveness of sins for the world. And anyway, requesting an audience with Sheikh Fadlallah on the day before Ashura is kind of like asking for an audience with the Pope on Christmas Eve. He's kind of busy. But we tried it, and his secretary said, "No, he's not going to be able to meet with you." And then got back to us and said, "Actually, he will meet with you, but you have 2 minutes. You have 2 minutes, and after 1 minute and 59 seconds, I want you out of there." So I thought, well, what can I say? And, you know, by the time we finish shaking hands for the TV cameras, and, you know, and I only get half the time, what can I say? And on my way there, driving through the slums of South Beirut, very poor, the Shiite area of South Beirut, I saw this banner over the road. It said, "Intisar dem ala saif," the victory of blood over the sword. And I said, "That's what I'm going to talk about." And when I got there, I said, "What do you want to say to me?" So I said, "Well, I saw this banner, and what I understand it to mean is that Hussein, by his willingness to shed his own blood, won a greater victory than he could have by taking sword in hand and killing his enemies. And that's what I, as a Christian, believe about Jesus Christ on the cross, that Jesus could have killed his enemies. He said, I could pray, and God would send a legion of angels. But instead, he voluntarily, in love, laid down his life, praying for the forgiveness of his enemies. I said, I believe that that is the key to breaking the silence, the cycle of violence and hatred and revenge between your community and my community. And I waited for him to say, "Well, yeah, but we don't believe that Jesus died on the cross," and things like that. He turned to his followers and he said, "I agree with every word this Christian man of God has just said. And that's beautiful." So I said, "Well, thank you very much. I see it's 1 minute and 59 seconds, so time to go." He said, No, you don't go anywhere. But yeah, I want to talk to you some more." And he kept me there for 2 hours, after which I finally had to go because I had another appointment. And in the course of that, he asked me, "What do you have to say about the suffering of the Iraqi people in the war that your country started?" And I said, "I look at the suffering of any innocent victims of violence and injustice through the lens of the suffering and death of Jesus Christ, which to me is the sign of God's solidarity with all who are poor and oppressed and suffering injustice. And I think that you could say the same, you could view the same through the lens of Hussein's martyrdom. You could look at it and say, let's get revenge, or you could look at it and say, hey, let's love and forgive. And that's how I see it. And he said, I totally agree with you. It was shortly after that that the Abu Ghraib scandal broke, and Muslims around the Arab world were asking their leaders, how am I supposed to understand this as a Muslim? Should it be that, these people are wanting to kill us, and we need to kill them before they kill us? That would be one Muslim response. Instead, Hezbollah, under Sheikh Fadlallah's leadership, put a video on their TV channel, which is banned in the U.S. because they're terrorist ties, but they put a video on their TV channel, which is watched all across the Middle East, saying they used images and music from the movie The Passion of the Christ, and they said, the key to understanding the suffering of the Iraqi people right now is through the suffering and forgiving death of Jesus Christ. Now, if you're not a Muslim or a Christian, maybe you wouldn't be all that excited about the Jesus Christ stuff there. And my point is simply that here were people who were saying, should I hate these Americans? Should I hate these Christians? Should I try to get revenge? And here is a pretty radical Muslim leader who's certainly not known for pro-Americanism saying, you should react in terms of the forgiving love that Jesus Christ showed on the cross. And I think that's the kind of thing that can change attitudes and that can make peace in the Middle East. I've gone longer than I intended to. Sorry. Thank you for your patience. I think we've got some questions, so let's go to them.
Thank you very much, Joseph, for your insights that you've shared with us. We're with Joseph Cumming, the director of the Reconciliation Program for the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. I'd like to ask the first question to follow up on what you described as a proposal that could be accepted by the different interests in the Middle East. What does it take to put that on the table? Is it merely that President Obama and Hillary Clinton decide that they will indeed put it on the table and can muster the American support for whatever budgetary implication it has?
Yeah, I think a few things need to happen. First of all, President Obama himself, obviously working closely with the Secretary of State, but it's got to be that Middle Eastern societies, they want to know what does the top guy think. President Obama himself would have to sit down with Prime Minister Netanyahu and with President Abbas and say, here's the deal I'm putting on the table. We can tweak it a little bit, but we're not going to radically move it one direction or the other. I'm willing to do some tweaking with you, but this is the deal. And if you feel that you can't accept it, will you put it in a referendum to your people? I don't think that you should say no to that. And he would have to be prepared to expend political capital to persuade them to make that referendum happen. And then, yes, he would have to go to the American people. And obviously the American taxpayers are wondering, why are we paying more money? And he would have to expend the political capital to persuade the American people that this is much cheaper than what we're now doing. I think that's the key. And then the other thing that would need to happen is that the Muslim, Christian, and Jewish religious leaders who are engaged with this process would need to get behind it and be supportive of it. And I believe that's very doable.
Do the Muslim leaders perceive the United States as a Christian nation? And is that why your emphasis on Muslim-Christian relations, is that an important piece of that? Or do they perceive us simply as a secular nation that needs to be brought into the solution to pressure the Israeli state?
Well, I think that most ordinary Muslims, not Muslim leaders, but most ordinary Muslims do think of America as a Christian country, and that whatever the American government does, that's what Christianity does. Whatever Hollywood puts in a movie, that's Christianity. Muslim leaders are obviously, they're more educated, they're more intellectual, they're more knowledgeable, they know better. My focus on Muslim Christian Jewish, and I would emphasize it's not just Muslim Christian, but Muslim Christian Jewish dialogue. And I'm not wanting to exclude Hindus and Buddhists and Jains and Sikhs and et cetera. But obviously, in the Middle East, the key players are Muslims, Christians, and Jews. My reason for focusing on that is because I believe that faith resources being brought to bear on the problem can help resolve it. I don't think faith resources are the only thing needed. I think political resources are needed as well. But I think Muslim leaders do understand that America is a diverse and pluralist country.
There are a number of questions about the history and how we got to the impasse that we now face. What is it that turned the Middle Ages tolerance of Muslim countries into the hostility which exists today towards the West and the West's hostility towards the Muslim countries?
First of all, I think there was more hostility on both sides in the Middle Ages than most people recognize. I'm going to be disagreeing with a prominent colleague of mine at Yale who wrote a book about medieval Spain that described it as a Shangri-La of interfaith tolerance. And it certainly was relatively tolerant for the Middle Ages, but certainly not always a model of tolerance. I think there was plenty of hostility on both sides in the Middle Ages, notable examples of tolerance on both sides in the Middle Ages. But what has radicalized things in the modern era is first colonialism and now the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And Muslims have experienced, from their point of view, violence, marginalization, and humiliation at the hands of the West, at the hands of, from their point of view, Christians and Jews. They're angry about it, and I think until those issues are addressed, we won't be able to have normal relations with the Muslim world. The Muslim public opinion is radicalized by that reality.
We're here again with Joseph Cumming, the director of the Reconciliation Program for the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. Since 1967, that you referred to as a possible solution, returning close to the borders of 1967, the two symbolic things which seem to have raised greatest anger in the Muslim world and the Palestinian world are the settlements and the wall. Are those non-negotiables that must be reversed, that we must move the settlements back, the settlers out, and end the building of the wall and tear it down?
Well, I'm glad that somebody raised the question of the settlements and the wall. And I really think anybody who ever, if you go to Israel as a tourist or as a religious pilgrim, you really should, you owe it to yourself and to your own conscience to go look at the wall up close and go look at it from the Palestinian side of the wall. It's quite an overwhelming emotional experience that no amount of seeing pictures of it can give you a feeling for what it's like. Certainly those are, the wall and settlements are a serious problem. That said, the Israeli government has always insisted that the wall is not intended as where they're planning for the border to be. So I think that if we're going to have peace talks, we need to say, okay, let's see whether that's really true. Let's take them at their word that this is a temporary wall and is not necessarily the permanent location of a border. And obviously, on their own land, the Israelis have the right to put up any wall they want to put. But on Palestinian land, the Palestinians have the right to tear down anything they want to tear down. And obviously, we need to decide among the parties where's the border going to be. The settlements are a huge problem. The Palestinians generally recognize that Ma'ale Adumim, that is the largest settlement that is larger than all the others put together east of Jerusalem, that's not going to go away. One of the questions that has not really been adequately explored is if there's a Palestinian state in which some settlements are still located within the borders of that state, could some of those Jewish settlers be allowed to become Palestinian citizens and continue to live there. That's not really been explored, and I don't know what the parties would say because they've not really been asked that question, but it's worth asking.
Your center is called the Yale Center for Faith and Culture, and your program is the Reconciliation Program. What role does forgiveness and reconciliation play? Does there have to be a truth and reconciliation commission a la South Africa that might indeed lead to a full airing of all grievances? Is that a necessary part of the healing process?
Well, I think that the South African model is a good model, and I do believe that forgiveness is key to reconciliation. And forgiveness is an interesting thing. And if you forgive me for speaking as a Christian, when I look at Jesus on the cross saying, praying, forgive them for they know not what they do, in the very act of forgiving people for their wrongdoing, you are naming it as wrongdoing, right? By saying forgive them, he's in effect saying it's not okay what they're doing. What they're doing is wrong, but I forgive it. Rather than saying I'm going to sweep it under the carpet and ignore it and pretend it didn't happen, he's saying, no, I believe this was wrong, and yet I'm still not going to hold it against them. And I think that is the key to reconciliation in the relations between the West and the Muslim world, in the relations in the Middle East between Israelis and Palestinians. The grievances are deep. The grievances are real on both sides. Terrible crimes have been committed on both sides towards one another. And just sort of saying, well, let's not think about it. Let's just pretend that didn't happen. I don't think that will work. I think we do need to name things in order to forgive them. And whether a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in the Middle East is helpful, I don't know. Personally, I would like to see, I think it was Senator Leahy just said last week about things that have been done by our country in recent years. Before I turn the page, I'd like to read the page and see what's on it. By all means, I agree with President Obama. Let's turn the page, let's not keep looking back. But before we turn the page, let's do read it and see what's on it. And I think that's right. In order to forgive, you have to recognize wrongdoing and then forgive.
We're again with Joseph Cumming from the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. There are several questions about the broader regional context of the Israeli-Palestine conflict. How important is it to simultaneously deal with the other issues in the region of Muslim West flare-ups? You mentioned that this is the key to the solution of the other problems, but can it alone be addressed, or do we have to address the broader regional issues simultaneously?
Well, obviously you have a land issue with Syria and Lebanon, I think Syria and Lebanon are not going to sign on to a peace deal which does not resolve the issue of the Golan Heights and the Shebaa Farms. But the Arab League as a whole has said that if Israel withdrew all the way to the 1967 borders and some sort of just resolution was found to the refugee issue, that the Arab League as a whole would recognize Israel's right to exist and make peace with Israel. Now, the Syrians are the most skeptical in the Arab League about that, and at the recent Arab League summit in Doha, the Syrians declared that initiative dead, and the wider Arab League said, no, it's not dead, but it's not going to be on the table forever. So I think that if the Israeli-Palestinian conflict can be resolved, I think that almost all of the Arab world will be prepared to make peace with Israel. Syria, the issue of the Golan Heights and the Shebaa Farms will still need to be dealt with if Israel wants to make peace with Syria and Lebanon. But I think actually that's a relatively simpler problem to solve. And obviously there are negotiations already going on with the Syrians about that. If I were an Israeli politician, I would love to call Syria's bluff about the Shebaa Farms and call Hezbollah's bluff, withdraw from that farm, those farms, and see whether Syria really recognizes Lebanon's right to that land. Some of you may know what I'm talking about here, and whether Hezbollah is really willing to resist anybody who's occupying that land, even if it's Syria. It would be very interesting to see how that would play out between Hezbollah and Syria. I think that would actually be a smart move by the Israelis.
Afghanistan and Iraq, clearly American involvement there has been criticized heavily by the Muslim leaders. With President Obama moving more aggressively on Afghanistan, is there hope to gain Muslim trust as long as that Afghanistan conflict continues?
Well, first of all, in the case of Iraq, I think there is a genuine general view when I talk with Muslim leaders, a recognition that it is legitimate that President Obama does want to pull American troops out of Iraq, and it's legitimate for it to take a little bit of time. And I think they're willing to be patient about that. Obviously, there are extremists who are not willing to be patient about it, but most Muslims are respectful of what President Obama is trying to do in Iraq. And I must say also, General Petraeus is actually quite well viewed in the Muslim world as being a good man who was stuck implementing what they think was a bad policy, but who they think is now implementing a better policy. In the case of Afghanistan, that's a more difficult situation. The one thing that can be said is although Muslims strongly, in general, most Muslims opposed the invasion of Afghanistan and are angry about it, they're not nearly as angry as they were about Iraq. Their perception is, well, America was attacked from Afghanistan. It was not attacked by Iraq. And so there was some understanding that the Americans had a legitimate grounds for going into Afghanistan. And there's a recognition across the Muslim world that so far, most Afghans do want NATO and the U.S. there. Now, if that were to change, and I think Afghan public opinion is in danger of shifting, especially when Afghan civilians get killed by NATO and U.S. forces, that hurts Afghan public opinion. If Afghan public opinion changed and wanted the Americans out and the Americans stayed, that would become a very, very serious problem for the U.S.
There are a couple of questions about the internal politics and religious politics within the Muslim world itself, the Shiite-Sunni conflicts and the Taliban versus more mainstream Muslim belief. To what extent are they going to influence and prevent the kind of reconciliation in the Middle East that you're hopeful for?
Well, certainly the division between Sunnis and Shia are deep and ancient and profound. There's profound division between Sunni and Shia. And far more Muslims are killed that way than Muslim terrorists kill far more Muslims across that divide than they ever killed of Westerners. Or Israelis, for that matter. It troubles me sometimes when Westerners lump sort of all of the Muslims whom we in the West don't like, I'm making quotation marks which people on the radio won't be able to hear, lump them all together as though the secular nationalist Ba'athists and the Shiites of Iran and the Salafi Sunnis of Al-Qaeda were all one thing, when these are radically differing groups with radically differing agendas. But if anything could have ever united these forces after 1,400 years of their being at each other's throats, it's amazing how American policy since 9/11 has brought these groups closer to each other than they ever were in history. It's amazing to see in Sunni Muslim countries people supporting Hezbollah, which is a Shiite group, just because they're so angry at America. But if America worked for a just peace in the Middle East, that Sunni support for Hezbollah would disappear overnight.
Okay. There are several questions about the policies within the more radical parts of the Muslim world, whether it be the educational system of the madrasas or the policies towards women. Is there any hope that we might change some of the values of the Muslim world through the kind of dialogue which you advocate, particularly questions regarding women's rights?
Well, obviously I am concerned to see gender equality promoted in the Muslim world and, for that matter, in our country. I remember having a conversation with the president of Al-Azhar University, which is the most important institution of Islamic scholarship in the Muslim world. And he was talking about how, look, we have real equality for women here at Al-Azhar. We have women deans, women professors. Almost half our student body are women, and he's talking about this. And I talked to one of the women deans, and I said, so is this true? Are you really treated as equals? And she said, I think he sincerely believes that, but no, we aren't. And I thought to myself, at Yale, if you asked us at Yale, the men and the women would give pretty much the same answer. You know, I think there's need for reform on gender equality in both the Muslim world and the West. But I think we need to recognize that reform in the Muslim world has got to be coming from within and cannot be imposed from without. If you can imagine how we would feel in America if the Saudis were in a position of relative power to us that we are now vis-a-vis them, and the Saudis said to us, you need to change your school curricula in America and change what you're teaching your elementary school children about Islam and change what you're... How do you think Americans would react? We'd be furious, right? Well, that's how Muslims react when we tell them we want to change their school curricula. But when we lay off a little bit and instead of publicly berating them, privately pull Muslim leaders aside and say, hey, how about this thing in this school book of yours? They say, yeah, you're right. We need to change that. And then they work for reform from within. Obviously, that doesn't make as good news copy for the newspaper, but I think it gets more results in the long run.
There are similar questions about the splits within Christianity in the West and whether the evangelical split with other branches of Christianity is going to get in the way of the kind of dialogue we need to have with the Muslim world.
Well, I am myself an evangelical, I must say I am a convert to the idea of interfaith dialogue. When I was first starting out in the ministry, I thought it was not a good idea, and I've become convinced that it is a good idea. And I think within the evangelical community, though there are still many skeptics about interfaith dialogue, there is a growing change of attitude within the evangelical community that, yes, we do need to be part of this process. In the past, the feeling in the evangelical community was that the gatekeepers who controlled interfaith dialogue said, you can't participate in interfaith dialogue if you make any kind of absolute truth claims, if you believe that your faith is the only true faith. And obviously, the large majority of Muslims in the world cannot sign on to that. Obviously, the Pope cannot sign on to that. And obviously, evangelicals cannot sign on to that. And Orthodox Jews cannot sign on to that, at least the large majority of them, which means that if that's the ground rules, then you've excluded the large majority of religious people in the world before you even got started. There's now a recognition that, no, you know, we can have mutually incompatible beliefs about the truth, and we may not ever resolve them, but we still need to make peace with each other. And if my faith tells me I have to love you as I love myself, and if you tell me your faith says you have to love me as I love myself, and if the people in our communities are not loving each other but are killing each other, then let's talk about that. And in the process, we can also talk about those truth claims, and certainly at the conference we hosted at Yale last summer, though we didn't come to agreement, I said, about the Trinity or the person of Jesus Christ, we did actually talk about the Trinity and the person of Jesus Christ quite a lot, and the prophethood of Muhammad and all of those issues. And we didn't come to agreement, but we had peaceable conversations, and we built some trust there. And so I think that actually we are now in an era where the evangelical community is prepared to engage very constructively with this process, as are traditionalist Roman Catholics who have been skeptical in the past, traditionalist conservative Muslims who have been skeptical in the past. I think we're moving into a new era in that regard.
And there is a question about Roman Catholic influence and some of the Pope's statements that have been interpreted as less than sensitive to both Jewish and Muslim interests. Does the Roman Catholic Church have the ability to play a role in this dialogue in the Middle East?
Well, certainly the Roman Catholic Church is playing a very important role in this dialogue. I mentioned that the Pope had written a response to the Common Word letter and welcomed a delegation of Muslim leaders to the Vatican, and they've started now a series of annual meetings. The Vatican also has a number of very important interfaith dialogue initiatives already in process with Al-Azhar University, which I mentioned is the dominant institution of Islamic scholarship in the world, with the government of Saudi, the King of Saudi Arabia, and a number of other very important interfaith dialogue things that the Vatican is involved in. Let me just say that I believe that the Pope's remarks at Regensburg were misunderstood. He made the remarks in German, and on the day after he made the remarks, the Vatican posted an official English translation on their website, which unfortunately, and it's unusual because the Vatican is usually very skilled at translation and cross-cultural diplomacy. They're usually brilliant at that, but they made an error in the translation in which they omitted an entire phrase of the Pope's remarks in which he distanced himself personally from Emperor Palaiologos' remarks that he quoted, which were so offensive to the Muslims, and that was not in the English translation, which went all over the Muslim world. And when the demonstration started and everything, I actually got interviewed on MSNBC about it, and I pointed out the error in the translation. And it was about 2 hours later that the Vatican fixed it. I don't know whether somebody from the Vatican saw my interview or they figured it out independently of me, but they fixed the translation. But it was too late because the version that had already circulated all over the Muslim world implied that the Pope agreed with Emperor Palaiologos, which was not what he intended.
We have a question about what we should be teaching our children to help prepare the next generation of Americans to engage in productive dialogue with both people who have different religions and different cultures in the Middle East and elsewhere. Do you have any suggestions about what we should be teaching and to our children, either through our schools or through our religious institutions?
Well, obviously, in general, our religious teaching is not through our schools, unless they are religious schools. What I would say is that for those of us who are religious believers, no matter what your religion is, we need to tell our children, not tell them, religion's a problem here, so don't get too religious when it comes to those Muslims or whatever kinds of other people who are not of our religion, but rather we need to highlight for our children the resources that are in our faith traditions where we can be authentically faithful to our faith traditions and to our scriptural traditions and say, you know what? If you're a Christian, Jesus said, loving your neighbor as you love yourself, loving God and loving your neighbor, that these are the two greatest commandments. You know, if you're Jewish, you say to your child, the same two commandments were highlighted by Rabbi Hillel as the two greatest commandments. If you're a Muslim, you do the same thing. I think if you're a non-religious person, I hope that you have taken a little bit of hope from my comments this evening, and you'll be thinking, you know, I don't need to tell my children religion's the problem and that God ruins everything. Because that's a message of despair to our children, since religion's not going away. People are not getting less religious. You know, if you might think if you're not religious, well, if people would stop being religious, there wouldn't be all these problems in the world. But people aren't going to stop being religious. People are getting more religious, not less. But if you can say, hey, actually, I think that faith traditions can promote peace, and I've seen examples of how they can promote peace, that would be a good thing to tell your children.
We have two more questions about what can we be doing in the United States to help more with this. This question is simply about where we should get our information. Do you have recommendations to us about news outlets, publications that give the most accurate picture of religious developments in the Middle East and political developments in the Middle East? What do you read?
Well, I can tell you what I read. And that is, I think when it comes to these kinds of issues, objectivity is not always possible. Objectivity is desirable, but not always possible. And sometimes it's more helpful if we can hear what all the sides of a debate think, hear all of the biases in order to form our own judgments. And I think in the international news media, the best news outlet that I find in English that gives me all the sides, all the perspectives, is BBC News. And so I read the news on their website every day. And in fact, I read every single Middle East story every single day. The other thing I do is I watch Al Jazeera every day, not because I agree with everything Al Jazeera says, but because I want to understand how Arab Muslims are feeling about the news. I may disagree, but I want to understand where they're coming from. I often tell my students, I think that's one of the chief marks of a well-educated person, is the ability to listen to a point of view you disagree with. You may disagree with passionately, until you could explain that other person's point of view so clearly that they would say, yeah, that's what I think. And that's what I try. I try to understand by watching Al Jazeera every day. Now, you might say, well, but I can't watch Al Jazeera because I don't know Arabic like you. But Al Jazeera English, you can watch. Even though it's not available on cable anywhere in America, they have a YouTube channel. And you can watch little three-minute news clips and whole full-length programs on their YouTube channel. So I encourage you to watch the Al Jazeera's YouTube channel. And, you know, you may not agree with, you probably won't agree with many of the things you see there, but you'll at least be able to understand how the world looks through other people's eyes.
And one last question, which is the attitude in the Middle East towards the United States influenced because of President Obama's election, because his middle name is Hussein? Does that have any genuine impact on Muslim attitudes towards either President Obama or the United States?
Let me just add, I also do look at the American news media. I was telling you the international, but I do read the New York Times. I mentioned I watch CNN this morning. I watch CNN. I also watch Fox News, even though I frequently disagree with them, because I want to understand their point of view, even if I disagree with it. There is great interest in the Muslim world about President Obama's middle name. There are a few Muslims who are not that well educated who think maybe he's a Muslim, but most, you know, Muslims do know that he is a Christian. And there is a wide feeling like, okay, he had a Muslim father who was maybe not very devout, actually became an atheist before he was born, but some kind of a Muslim for a father. And he spent part of his childhood in a Muslim country. And we think that maybe because of that, he'll understand our concerns better than other American presidents would. The other thing that I find in the Muslim world, though, is their perception that because he did that work as a community organizer among the poor in on the south side of Chicago, maybe he has understanding and sympathy for the poor and the oppressed. And since most people in the Muslim world think of themselves as poor and oppressed, they feel like maybe he'll be more sympathetic with our plight than he would otherwise be.
Well, Joseph Cumming, thank you for giving us such an optimistic, a hopeful, but realistic view of the potential for peace in the Middle East. I hope you all have enjoyed this evening's program of the Yale Club of Silicon Valley and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank Joseph Cumming, Director of the Reconciliation Program for the Yale Center for Faith and Culture, our audience here in Mountain View, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting is adjourned. We're done. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everyone.